A son halfway across the world sent his DNA to a database in an attempt to find out more about his secretive father's childhood as an orphan. What he found was that his dad had killed his parents, escaped from prison, and began living a double life under an alias. This is the story of William Leslie Arnold, the loving father in Australia who also happened to be a cold-blooded killer in America. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here, and hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. When I first started reading about this case, it hit a little too close to home for me. A young man wanted to take his parents' car to the drive-in theater. They said no, and he did it anyway. It reminded me of the day that teenage Katie wanted to take her parents' minivan to her best friend's house. They said no, and she did it anyway. The only difference is that my parents called up my best friend's mom to send me home, while today's subject killed his parents so he could get away with it. It started on the evening of September 27, 1958. William Leslie Arnold, known as Leslie, wanted to catch a double feature at the local drive-in, but you need a car for that. In case any of you youngins don't know what a drive-in is, it's an outdoor movie theater where you drive your car into a parking lot facing a big screen where the movie gets projected. There used to be a little speaker on a pole that you'd attach to your car window, but the ones that still exist these days are more likely to let you tune into the movie using your car's own speaker system. They became popular in the 1940s and 1950s because people liked that they could smoke in their cars or let their kids run around the nearby playground while they watched the movie. And, oh yeah, you could make a move on your best girl in the back row without anyone noticing. Leslie was born on August 28, 1942, in Omaha, Nebraska. On the night in question, the 16-year-old wanted to go see No Time for Sergeants and The Undead at the drive-in. He just couldn't do it without his parents' car. But Opal Arnold wasn't budging, so he killed her and William Arnold. And then he went to the show with his girlfriend, and then he buried his parents in the backyard, and then he went to school and church. He even went to open his dad's household goods business at the start of the day and asked an employee to keep an eye on it. He kept on living his life like nothing had happened. When people asked where his parents were, he said they were on a trip to find his grandfather, who was senile and wandered off a train from California to Wyoming. Somehow people believed that. But the ruse didn't last long. On October 10, 1958, a neighbor talked to Leslie's grandmother and realized there was no train and no one had wandered off anything. She called the police. The next day, the high school saxophonist led officers into the family's backyard and pointed toward a bush with a cuffed hand. It was his mother's arm they found first as they began digging, her bracelet still on her wrist. The stay-at-home mom and the consumer product salesman were buried beneath the lilacs. A neighbor said, "Oh, Leslie, how could you do it?" Leslie was originally charged with first-degree murder because it seemed that he'd stopped and taken the time to load the .22-caliber Remington he took from his parents' closet. That showed that it was premeditated. He said he just wanted to scare his mom, to show her that he was going to take the car to the movies, but his mom had laughed at him, and he was tired of being treated like a child. The first-degree murder charge was eventually lessened to get a guilty plea, and on June 2, 1959, Leslie agreed to 2 counts of second-degree murder. It was just months before his 17th birthday, and yet he was sentenced to life behind bars in the Nebraska State Penitentiary. He had, after all, put 6 bullets each into his mother and father. Leslie had been a decent student, well-behaved. The only mark against him was for not wearing a belt to school one day. He was a multi-sport athlete, a marching band geek, and the kind of guy who wore his hair slicked back so he'd look like Elvis. It was shocking to imagine him shooting his parents in their dining room. Although there were certainly signs that Leslie wasn't like every other marching band kid. One neighbor called him smart but troubled, with a tightly wound temper. He would smash model airplanes if he couldn't figure out the pieces quickly enough. He once dented the roof of his parents' car with his own fist when his wax wasn't going on the way he wanted it to. One psychiatrist later called Leslie a smoldering volcano. And his anger had left his brother, 3 years younger, alone and orphaned. Although maybe it wasn't the worst thing in the world for him, having Leslie in prison. Leslie had been the type of brother to put socks on his hand so he could beat Jim without leaving any evidence. And the way he was raised certainly didn't help Leslie. His mom ruled the house with an iron fist, and Leslie said her control was domineering and arbitrary. And to me, there's nothing worse than not being able to anticipate what will upset someone. Especially with a parent, you shouldn't have to walk on eggshells. But she was the type of woman who'd make fun of his love of music and make him mow the grass again and again until it was even enough for her. No wonder he'd become so angry with himself for not getting his model airplanes right. When his mom would kick his dad out of the house while on one of her tears, he would tell Leslie that they just needed to put up with it for the greater good of the family. So the night that Leslie wanted to take his girlfriend to the drive-in and his mom didn't want him to see that girl from what she considered a trash family, maybe that was the last crack in a childhood lived on thin ice. Leslie said his mom had nervous breakdowns and he was always having to pay the price. But of course, his brothers said that the other side of the coin was that Leslie was also just a misbehaving kid. But in prison, he was more of a Boy Scout than anything. And in those days, prisoners were pardoned all the time after serving a short time. Leslie would need to serve at least 10 years based on state law, but he was just a kid at the time of his crime and had a completely clean history before that, so 10 years seemed like the absolute max he'd serve before being pardoned or paroled. The warden even seemed to almost take pity on Leslie because he was such a young guy and so obviously out of his element in prison. He was protected, he got his high school degree, he became editor of the jailhouse newspaper, he played his beloved sax in the inmate band, and his girlfriend's parents, you know, the trash family, became his legal guardians. Leslie just had to keep his head down and serve his 10 years, and he could probably go on to live a normal, productive life. But after 5 years, he wrote an appeal saying he hadn't known about the Fifth Amendment and his right not to incriminate himself. He said he'd been pressured to admit he was guilty. When this petition didn't get him anywhere, Leslie started acting out here and there, complaining all of the time and breaking rules. But I mean, we're still talking like cooking himself a special breakfast when he was supposed to be working in the kitchen. So in 1965, Leslie was given permission to live in a lower security area of the prison with its own dorm and guards, still definitely behind bars, but with more of a focus on work and with more freedom for Leslie to practice his music. It was a step toward regular life on the outside. But it still wasn't good enough for Leslie, and his inmate buddies knew he was marinating on how best to bust out. So one of them made an intro between the now 24-year-old Leslie and another prisoner who was 6 years older and needed the creative wit of the hardworking musician. They plotted with a third man who was getting paroled soon. He was getting out in May and would need a little time to get things together, so they decided sort of randomly on a date of July 14th, 1967. On July 5th, the paroled co-conspirator put an ad in the personal section of the newspaper, just a few code words to tell the prisoners the plan was still on. Then on the 14th, he drove by the prison and threw a cardboard tube with hacksaw blades and masks inside over the barbed wire fence. The other prisoner still on the inside had been going on morning walks, so it wouldn't seem suspicious that he was out that day when the tube came over for him and Leslie. No one saw it, and no one thought anything of him being outside. Leslie and this other inmate sawed through some bars over the windows in a music room instead of going to dinner two nights in a row. No one saw that either, and no one suspected anything because they then put the bars back into place using chewing gum. Now, I really thought that the thing about the masks must be made up because what kind of guard would be fooled by some inmate wearing a Groucho Marx costume? But it turns out they weren't wearing the masks. They were using them in the time-honored tradition of teenagers the world over who want to sneak out of the house. They bunched up their blankets to look like there was a body underneath the covers, and then used the masks as heads for their dummies. It didn't have to look that realistic because the guard would just be walking by while the lights were out. Still, they trimmed the mustache off Groucho Marx to not draw too much attention to the faces. That night, the two would-be escapees went through the solid bars in the music room, tossed a shirt over the 12-foot barbed wire fence to lessen the sharp jabs, and prayed the guard in the watchtower would just happen to not take notice of them. They were in luck. When they reached the tree line nearby, their parolee friend was waiting with a car and a change of clothes. He dropped them off at a bowling alley in Omaha, where Leslie called a friend from his childhood who agreed to help them with a ride to the bus station and all of the cash he had. This was a guy who was in seminary at the time, putting his neck on the line for these two out of friendship, for a guy who'd killed his parents. He would say later that he knew Leslie was mostly a good guy who would never do anything like that again, and he didn't feel any guilt about helping them break out even after he became a minister. By the time Leslie and his accomplice got off the 3 a.m. bus to Chicago, it was far too late for the prison guards, who were having police comb a 30-mile radius in what we know was a completely futile effort. It's assumed that the other inmates back in their dorm hid the mask to slow down the guards, and it didn't help that they were working with an intake photo of Leslie from when he was 7 years younger and 40 pounds lighter. Just as quickly as Leslie and this other prisoner had formed an unstoppable duo, they said goodbye in Chicago and never crossed paths again. In a matter of days, maybe proving how charming he was or how good a liar he was or what Elvis-like good looks he had, Leslie had a job and a woman who was willing to let him move in. Studies show slightly different numbers, but somewhere between 90% and, I kid you not, 99% of escaped convicts are captured, and Leslie's buddy was one of them. It was 1968, and Martin Luther King Jr. had just been killed by James Earl Ray. And James Earl Ray happened to look like this prisoner who was on the lam. A woman spotted him at a bar in Los Angeles, called him in, and got him arrested. Wrongfully, but as luck would have it for the Nebraska State Penitentiary, also rightfully. He said it was actually a relief to get caught, that he spent 9 months looking over his shoulder and was just happy to go back to serving his time and getting paroled like a normal person. In 2004, 37 years later, an investigator for the Nebraska prison system picked up Leslie's case in an effort to see if any of the corrections department's open folders could be closed. And it was just so interesting to him that he worked the case like it was brand new, interviewing friends and family, finding the parolee who drove the getaway car, having an age progression photo made, and even trying to track down who had searched Leslie's inmate number in the prison database years later. He felt he was getting somewhere, but he didn't exactly know what his endgame was. He didn't think it made a lot of sense to return Leslie to prison at this point, but he had to keep going, and all of the clues he could find pointed to South America. Even the inmate who escaped with Leslie said Leslie believed he wouldn't be extradited if he had a baby with a Brazilian citizen. And indeed, in 2017, a resident alien card from Brazil was found with the name William Leslie Arnold on it, registering him as an immigrant in December 1968. It was found, of all places, on a genealogy website by an Omaha resident who had been following the case in the local newspaper. The Omaha World Herald had been releasing these wonderful articles about Leslie after journalist Henry J. Cord took a special interest. So that meant that a year and a half after his escape, Leslie was still living under his own name. The back of the Brazilian residency card shows that Interpol knew the FBI was looking for a man by the name of Les Arnold, but it's unclear if Brazil refused to help or couldn't help apprehend him. And that's as far as our intrepid local journalist got in 2017. Authorities knew where Leslie went after his escape from Nebraska, but they had no idea where he ultimately ended up and what turns his life had taken. One cousin of Leslie's said, "I think everyone would be better off if he's not found. I'd like to think that he had gone beyond what he was at the time, didn't hurt anyone else, or didn't do anything he shouldn't have. I'd like to know that he is done okay by the world." The end. Just kidding. Here's how they caught him. The U.S. Marshals were still on the case in 2020 when it was handed off from one deputy to another, almost as a joke. You know, like, good luck, enjoy, glad it's you and not me down this rabbit hole now. But the new deputy figured that it was worth a shot in this new era of genetic genealogy. So he requested a DNA sample from Leslie's brother and uploaded it to one of the popular public registries. The big commercial databases like 23andMe don't allow law enforcement to add DNA collected from crime scenes. But in this case, a living relative agreed to upload his DNA and give authorities access to it, which is a great way to get the same result without breaking the rules. Nothing happened at first, so the deputy just continued about his business for 2 years when a match came back. A message quickly followed from a young man looking for information. This guy was a strong match to Leslie's brother, obviously a close relative, and he said he was trying to find out more about his dad, an orphan from Chicago. Bingo. His dad had unfortunately died in 2010 at the age of 67, but wow, what a life he had led. On August 9th, 2022, the case of William Leslie Arnold was officially solved. It only took 55 years. When the deputy called Leslie's son and explained that he wasn't a relative but law enforcement who had uploaded the DNA, Leslie's son asked what his dad had done to get the attention of the authorities. The deputy said, well, he was an orphan. He didn't lie about that. But he killed his parents. That's why he was an orphan. Suddenly, so much made sense to his children. Why Leslie seemed so private. Why he kept so few friends. Why he hated surprise parties. Why he seemed like a loner. William Leslie Arnold was just doing everything in his power to keep his former life at bay. But of course, his family didn't even know him as Leslie Arnold. To them, he was John Vincent Damon. When he ended up in Chicago after his prison escape, Leslie assumed his new name, forged a birth certificate, and got a job as a cook thanks to his time in the prison kitchen. 134 days after leaving Nebraska, he was married to a waitress at his restaurant. She was 10 years older, a divorced mother of four named Jean Bouvia, and you can imagine how much of a shield she and her daughters became for Leslie, now known as John. No one would suspect the family man, even if he only looked a few years older than his kids. He eventually became a salesman like his dad, but instead of owning a shop, Leslie traveled with his wares, like linens and chemicals. He moved the family to Cincinnati, Ohio, and then Miami, Florida. They only spent 2 years in any one place. His stepdaughters called him smart and hardworking and are grateful he helped get them out of the poverty they were living in before he came along. But they also said he was demanding and strict, which makes sense when you think about how disciplined he needed to be to make sure he never ended up in the hands of the law. A simple broken taillight could have ended it all for him. It's just a little funny that the boy who shot his mother for being too overbearing became a man who was that way himself. Leslie's stepdaughters wonder now if their mom believed that he really was an orphan or if she knew more but was willing to overlook it for the sake of a better life for her kids. Leslie and his first wife separated in 1977, likely because he worked too much and always wanted to move. He took off for LA, where he officially got divorced and then married another woman in 1983. She was a foreign exchange student. He had his first daughter with her in 1986 and then a son 5 years later. Years went by, and then suddenly in 1992, Leslie wanted to make a big change. He wanted nothing to do with the stepdaughters he'd remained in contact with. He wanted a mole taken off his face. That mole just so happened to be mentioned in every FBI wanted poster. And he wanted to move to New Zealand, so they did. They spent 5 years living there before moving again, this time to Australia. That's where he died in 2010 from blood clots due to deep vein thrombosis. It's unclear if Leslie ever actually went to Brazil, but there's a chance that his work took him there and he registered as a resident alien to confuse the authorities, or there's a chance he sent someone there to pretend to be him for the same reason. Whereas his stepdaughters paint the picture of a more serious father, Leslie's second family calls him charismatic and doting. He told his kids he became a different person when they were born. His son says, "My dad's legacy is a lot more than the initial crime and escape." He does remember, though, his dad wanting the whole family to watch the Clint Eastwood movie Escape from Alcatraz, where the characters take off and leave dummies behind in their beds. Leslie must have been dying to tell his kids that he had done the exact same thing in his old life long ago, but of course he only ever told them just enough. Like, he said that he had once worked for a dentist, he just didn't say that it was while he was in prison. In fact, he was so dedicated to his lie by this time that even when his son began playing the saxophone, Leslie only ever picked it up exactly one time. This was a guy who played sax in his high school band and the prison band, who loved music more than anything, and he never once told his son that he had any history with it. Leslie's son only learned that his dad may have been keeping secrets when he tried to find Leslie's old orphanage in Chicago and learned that it didn't exist. Then he visited the county clerk and found that the birth certificate that he thought was his dad's was a fake. That's when he tried to find out more by adding his DNA to that public registry. He says now, "They don't put any warning out there that maybe you won't like what you find, but I don't regret doing it, and I'm glad I now know the truth about my dad. Although it's shocking to know that his life began with a terrible crime, his legacy is so much more than that. I want him to be remembered for being a good father and provider to us, and instilling in me a passion for music and a drive to always be the best person I can be." Now knowing William Leslie Arnold's complete story, the investigator for the Nebraska prison system who picked up the case all those years later said, "The police officer and me always wanted to arrest him and bring him in, but you know, that wasn't the outcome. But I gotta tell you, I have spoken to his family several times now. They are an incredible family, and I won't say much about them out of privacy concerns, but what I will say is this. I think ultimately he became the parent who he wanted to be, or the one he wished he had. Because from everything I've noticed, it seems like he was a good provider and a good father. He raised some pretty great kids." But of course, at the opposite end of Leslie's son, there's Jim Arnold, the younger brother who was left orphaned by Leslie's actions. He had to go live with distant relatives when his parents were murdered. He had to transfer schools and try to pretend that his parents died in a car wreck, hide his secret from his own kids down the road, learn to grapple with everything in therapy. He said he doesn't want his brother to be seen as some sort of hero, that he doesn't want anyone to be impressed by the prison break. He said he still thinks about what happened every day, and while he's forgiven his brother, he doesn't want to know him. I guess he doesn't have to worry about that anymore. Leslie's kids say that he read his Bible front to back several times, and that all of the verses he highlighted had to do with sins and forgiveness. They think he was sorry for his past and had vowed in his heart to change. I just thought that this was such an interesting case because it's hard to reconcile the kind of person who murders his mom and dad at such a young age and goes on to escape from prison with this warm, loving, Bible-reading father. It brings up all sorts of questions about who should go to prison and how long they should spend there. Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.